The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Conley, Judge Larkin, Judge Shellhaus, the Honorable Francis J. Conley presiding.
My first question is to all the parties and the panel. Can everyone hear me?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank
yes.
you.
Yes, Judge.
Thank you very much. Our second case this morning is file A19-2002, City of Mountain Lakes versus, I hope I pronounced this right, Hebert Greenhouses of Minnesota et al. As all parties are aware, counsel for the appellant will have 15 minutes and counsel for the respondent will have 15 minutes. And then finally, appellant will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. So counsel for the appellant, you may begin. Please tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Joseph Ganji. I represent the appellants in this matter. I have both Marjorie and Paul Christensen present in the office with me at a safe 6 feet that way. We're here this morning on a hazardous building statute. This is kind of not a very common statute to be brought forward, and I think that's due to the remedy involved, which has been labeled by courts as a drastic remedy. It allows the municipality to essentially tear down a building without just compensation and actually requires the owner to pay for that demolition. So it is a pretty drastic remedy. Before authorizing this remedy, a few things need to happen. The owner needs to have a legitimate, meaningful chance to repair the hazardous condition. There needs to be a hearing if there's an answer, and under which the city or the municipality then has a chance and the burden to produce sufficient evidence to support the hazardous building determination. And then if the evidence is sufficient, a final chance to repair must be given to the homeowner. I'm asking today for the court to reverse the district court and set aside the city's order because the Christensens did not get that meaningful opportunity to repair through lack of notice. The evidence was insufficient at the hearing to support a hazardous building determination, and the Christensens were not given that final opportunity to repair.
Mr. Ganji, if we determine that the notice was insufficient, do we even have to reach the second and third issue?
No, Your Honor. If the notice was insufficient, the court would reverse based on that alone, and it would not matter as far as whether the evidence was insufficient or whether the judgment gave sufficient notice or opportunity to repair afterwards.
As I understand it, you know, the original notice did not include the list of repairs, and then they filed this amended resolution. But is it correct that that did not specify when they should complete the repairs either? Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. So and we have.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, sir.
I was just going to say, so the original order did allude to a list of repairs, but did not actually include any kind of list other than just to say, make it safe, which is very similar to both the Zimbrota case and the Swella case. In Zimbrota, there was not sufficient guidance on the repairs, and Swella was basically, you got to repair this on your own initiative. We have that pretty similar here where there's no real guidance on how to repair, what to do. It's just make it safe. The amendment doesn't really cure that lack of notice. It still doesn't give that list. And to me, it's even worse because what it does is it shifts the notice burden onto the Christensens. The city is now saying in the amendment that, okay, Christensens, you need to hire a structural engineer. You need to identify the problems on your property. You need to identify what repairs are going to be made. And then we'll determine if that's sufficient or not. That's actually shifting the notice burden onto the Christensens. And the city is the one that needs to provide that notice, not the other way around. But also, as far as the amendment goes, I don't even know if that should be considered at all. I mean, we talk about the original resolution, and the answer was made based on that original resolution. The amendment doesn't come out till months later. When you look at the Swella case, I understand that's an unpublished case, but it does provide a bit of guidance on how this process works. But it talks about how the original notice gives the owner an opportunity to decide whether it's necessary to repair or raise or answer, so they can make that decision. And here, the decision was made that the Christensens decided to do some of the repairs they thought were necessary, but that were ultimately inadequate. But they did file an answer too. And at that point, we get to a situation where now we have contested case hearings, and statute doesn't really allow for it an opportunity to amend that and basically start the notice process over. So I don't think that amendment should even be considered, but even if it is, it's still inadequate. The second issue with notice too is in addition to just the identification process, I'm making an argument as well that the notice here goes too far as what the Christensens were required to do. And certainly there's a spectrum here. You have to identify the issue and the repair at the minimum, and there comes a point in time where the city may require too much. And we should reference the statute here. What the statute requires is that the order needs to, the owner needs to correct or repair the hazardous condition. And if the city is requiring above and beyond repairing the hazardous condition, then that notice is insufficient because it goes too far. It's kind of like the, it's kind of like the Swella case. In the Swella case, the court talks about how the notice where it doesn't identify the issues actually gives a disincentive for the owner to comply, because they're going to do all this work and they don't know whether it's going to be sufficient or inadequate or whatnot. Same idea. If the city is saying, you guys need to, you have a hole in the roof and you got to demolish the entire roof and put on hurricane strength material or whatnot, whatever they decide to do, at that point, you have a disincentive to comply, because that is a considerable expense to go above and beyond repairing the hazard to a point where the owner might throw up their hands and say, I can't put in that kind of investment into the property. And that's kind of what we had here with the city saying, you need to get this up to code. And there's apparently debate about whether or not the greenhouses here need to comply with the code, but whether or not a building needs to comply with the state building code, I think, is a separate issue and doesn't really go towards the hazardous building issue, because being up to code doesn't mean that the building is hazardous. And you can, of course, repair a hazardous condition and still not be up to code, but now at least you have a code problem and not a problem where your building is going to be raised and you're going to be required to pay for that. With respect to the sufficiency of the evidence, I think it's important to note that statutory definition, we're looking at a condition, first of all, and then second of all, it has to constitute a hazard, but not just a hazard to the public safety. So it's not enough that you just have a hole in your roof. The hole in the roof has to constitute a hazard to public safety. I think the case cited by respondent, that Ukkonen case, is actually a pretty good example of what that means. And there's a whole list of problems in that case. But it really came down to, one, they had open sewers in that case, an unsanitary condition. And then second, they had the condition of the property to the extent that the property constituted a fire hazard. So in that situation, you have these conditions, they constitute a hazard to the public at large. And we don't have that here. We don't have any unsanitary conditions. We don't have any findings of fire hazards. There are some findings of the district court we dispute. The district court noted that the buildings were not secure, that the buildings were abandoned, and that the buildings attract rodents and vermin. We dispute those findings as not supported by the evidence. there's other findings such as the roof and the trusses and some trees growing, but that in no way has been related to a public health or public safety concern. Even if those conditions exist on the property, it has to be more than a private issue. It has to impact the public at large. I think the respondent is kind of relying here on the proximity to the school. That's a bit misleading. North of the property is the school athletic area. There's a track. The school itself is not located there, but even if it was, that's an issue or a repair that needs to be made on property does not jeopardize the public at large simply because you have people or kids who might trespass and commit crimes to get on private property and do who knows what else based on that. So those are my comments, Your Honor. I'd ask that the court reverse the district court for the insufficient notice and the city's order here. If the notice was sufficient, then the court should reverse based on insufficient evidence. If the court finds that there's sufficient evidence, then the case still needs to be reversed for the court to add in a sufficient opportunity to repair, which I don't think is possible under the facts of this case, but I think that's a district court decision. So unless there's no further questions of me, I thank the court for its time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ganji. We'll now hear from counsel for the respondent, please.
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Mary Ellen Zurhoff, counsel for respondent, City of Mountain Lake. The city was the plaintiff in the district court proceeding. The subject matter here is, did the city's resolution provide adequate notice to appellant, as counsel discussed? Are the buildings actually hazardous under the statute? Even so, are they exempt as agricultural buildings? Did the city provide adequate direction for appellants to address the hazards? And was the appellants given adequate opportunity to make the repairs? We state, Your Honor, that it did provide adequate notice. The resolution as amended provided adequate specificity for the repairs, especially considering that the city offered to meet with them on site to discuss each building, and the appellants refused to discuss it,
So, Ms. Zurhoff, you agree that the original notice did not contain the list of problems on the property?
Yes.
And then?
Yes, Your Honor. Would
you also agree, Ms. Zurhoff, that even in your amended notice, you did not include any discussion about, the time to make the repairs. Is that correct?
We asked them to provide a timeline for repairs. We were anticipating a discussion, a back and forth process. We actually gave them, instead of giving them a hard deadline, that was to their benefit, that we anticipated that they would make a proposal and that we could discuss what repairs needed to be made. So there was
at that point you were in litigation. I mean, they had filed an answer. I guess parties can, discuss settlements at any time during a litigation, but once they filed their answer. Well, first of all, the statute is silent about getting to fix whatever original notice there is. So, that sort of concerns me. And then second, the second notice wasn't even great. So it's sort of I'm not blaming you. Attorneys often have to come in at the last minute and, deal with whatever happens. But I will say, speaking for myself and not the panel, I don't think this is the way it's supposed to go, particularly when you're relying on the hazardous material statute. It seems to me, the remedies for that are so drastic that it seems to me there should be strict compliance, and I don't see that. So, you know, I appreciate, you know, your willingness to sort of work with them, you know, when things went south. Quite frankly, I think that was more to your benefit than theirs. But why shouldn't we enforce the statute as written? And since you didn't comply with it, why wouldn't we just reverse summarily because of your failure to comply with the notice provisions?
Thank you, Your Honor. I would submit that we did comply, that the there's nothing prohibiting an amended complaint. Just in any civil action, you can do an amended complaint. So the complaint in this case is the resolution by the, you know, the order from the city council. And that as soon as they provided our an answer by May, okay, they were served in originally, I believe it was April 8th. And by May 21st, we served an addendum. So that was very shortly thereafter. And I would dispute the accusation or the allegation that the addendum was not specific enough. We do list that the trusses must be replaced. The owner needs to replace the trusses the entire length of the building. If the trusses are rotted, then the entire group of trusses throughout each building have rotted also. The roof decking and assembly must be replaced. The bowing and buckling of the end wall must be removed and replaced. So that is the list of repairs, Your Honor.
But that addendum didn't specify the repairs on which building, did it?
No, I think that I agree, Your Honor. I think it's disingenuous for the appellants to say, hey, you know, you didn't give us enough specifics on a building to building basis when we asked them numerous times, let us on your property, we'll go over each building with you and we can make it more specific. But they didn't communicate with us. They refused to give us access. We believe that we have the definition. So on the deficiency on the notice issue, the statute provides little guidance on the specificity required in that notice, which we are talking about now. Zimbrota says that the order must be sufficiently certain to provide the property owner with notice of the alleged hazardous conditions. We did do that. The alleged has basically these buildings are collapsing, and that is a hazardous condition. We are saying basically that they're unsecure structurally. These buildings are not structurally sound anymore, and that you have to address the structure of the buildings. And so if we had to provide a detail on each specific repair, then the statute would have required an engineering report. The statute doesn't do that. Basically, it's designed for the city council to pass an order kind of giving notice to the owner. And if it had to have specifications, then I believe that the legislature, if they intended that, would have required that the city do an engineering report. Also, it just said, all our addendum said for the buildings with significant damage that the owner would have to make sure the buildings are safe to the public and meet the proper codes.
Do you agree with Mr. Ganji that, you know, you can cure a hazardous condition and still not, and it could still be out of code compliance?
Yes, Your Honor.
These are greenhouses, and, you know, let's say there's, you know, fertilizer which can explode or something if it's left, you know, in the sun. You know, you can take all that stuff out and still have, you know, a building with holes in it and a bad roof and it leaks, but it's no longer hazardous. And then I would imagine, you know, you'd go a different road and have this building inspector come in and say, well, you know, this isn't up to code, this isn't up to code, blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, you've got X many days, and if you don't fix it, I mean, it goes down the line. But I'm not so sure. Well, explain to me, even if somehow we think the amended notice works, explain to me why you don't lose on the sufficiency of the evidence argument.
The sufficiency of the evidence. Okay. I thought you were going to address the code issue. May I address the code issue first?
Yes, go right ahead. Go right ahead. Thank you, Ms. Shurhoff.
Okay. So in the city of Litchfield versus Schwanke, 530 Northwest 2nd 580, the court ordered the owner to bring the building up to code. They used that word, up to code, and ensured the building was not open to trespass. But I think if you want, the major issue here is that the buildings are collapsing. And they talk about the trusses and the rafters. And so if they wanted to replace them and make them secure, what do we go by? If you want a building structurally sound, then you have to go by the building code. And the city of Mountain Lake has adopted the building code. So if they went, it's really phase two. Once they determined what they wanted to do, if they wanted to save those buildings, they would have to apply for a building permit and comply with the building code. And then I can address later the issue that they're not exempt because these buildings are no longer agricultural buildings. But Your Honor, I don't think we really even get to that point because they can't show a hardship because they never even tried or they never even went that step. The building code also allows the city to enforce ordinances as far as just general maintenance of buildings based on the code when the building was built. And if they went to replace the building and said, okay, we're gonna operate a nursery again, then maybe they would have been exempt. So I think if this just jumps ahead, I don't think it's even ripe, the issue of whether or not they had to meet the building code and what specifications, I don't think is even, we didn't even get to that point because they never even tried, they never even communicated, and we don't know what their intent would be and what repairs that they would want to make. So I think that it's speculative as to exactly what criteria they would have to meet. If they were just replacing glass, maybe, you know, that may not even include the building code, whereas of course the structural, which is what we are trying to address in this addendum, for the buildings with significant damage, they would have to meet the proper building code to be safe. And we also, and this is in contrast to Zimbrota. Zimbrota just said, the original order just said, eliminate the hazard. And in Asuela v. Wells, the order just said, well, you have to raise the building. They didn't even give them an opportunity to repair. So we believe that our notice is adequate under the statute because basically we did provide that you have to make these buildings structurally sound if you want to replace them. The appellants also allege that they are exempt because they're agricultural buildings. Well, if you look at the transcript, that the owners admitted that this was not in operation since 2014. So there's no ongoing commerce, there's nothing being grown and sold, it's not a business anymore. So now it's just a commercial building and they have to comply with current codes. We believe the appellants were given ample opportunity to address the hazards and make repairs. They were served in February. We didn't have the trial until September, and they refused access, would not talk to the city, would not meet with us, and they made no attempt to address the hazards. The owner testified that he fixed a panel and locked a couple of doors, but if the court would look at Exhibit 6, which are the pictures of the buildings, you could see that, you know, fixing one panel or locking one or two doors is not going to address the hazards. You could see that many panels, the glass is missing, trees are growing out of the buildings, the buildings are collapsing. And so any repairs that the owners did were just minor and just insufficient to address the hazards. Secondly, they didn't communicate with us and didn't even tell us what improvements they had made. So we didn't know until trial that they even made an attempt to address the hazards.
Does the statute provide for discovery?
Yes, Your Honor, and I did serve interrogatories. They didn't respond until right before the trial.
Is there anything else, Ms. Shurhoff?
Well, we believe that the building inspector provided adequate information to determine that the buildings were hazardous. You have a school next door. The owners admitted that there were trespasses on several occasions. The buildings were collapsing. It's irrelevant whether they were collapsing from snow load or from just age. There was, you know, the siding had collapsed and so forth. The buildings were dilapidated and they met the definition of hazard under UConn, the Supreme Court decision.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ms. Shurhoff. Your time has expired. Mr. Ganji, you'll have the last word, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple of brief comments. On the first, as far as the amended resolution goes, certainly there's nothing prohibiting an amended complaint according to the rules of civil procedure. We're here, though, under a resolution adopted by a city council, not a complaint. And I'd also note that as far as an amendment goes, once an answer has been filed under the civil rules, you need permission from the court to amend your complaint, so to speak, or you need written concession from the other party to do that. And here that resolution came after an answer was already served. And so if we're looking at that as far as allowing an amendment to the resolution, I don't think that gets anywhere. Second comment, just briefly, is the idea that the Christensens never tried to comply here. I don't think that's true at all. When the Christensens received the resolution, it talked about security, not in the sense of structural security, but in the sense of access security, because it was tied to allowing this possibility of vermin or critters to enter. And so Mr. Christensen did testify as to all the efforts he made to ensure that the buildings were secure in that sense. And then he made other repairs as well, addressed some tree problems, that kind of thing. And when the resolution the amendment to the resolution comes back and requires so much more, especially with the code piece, and Mr. Christensen says, you know what, my building is exempt from the code. Why do my repairs need to be up to code? that provides that disincentive I was talking about as far as making any additional efforts. I don't believe it's the Christensen's role or even responsibility to necessarily provide the city with evidence to use against them, especially once the resolution has already been enacted by the city saying you have a hazard and the option is repair to some unspecified level or file an answer. At that point, yeah, they can talk about settlement, absolutely, but when you have that contested case proceedings and the idea of allowing just voluntarily the city to come on and develop the evidence they should have already had to begin with, I don't know why anybody would necessarily do that. Those are all my comments, Your Honor. I'd ask that the court reverse the district court here in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ganji. Thank you, Ms. Schurhoff. We appreciate the quality of your arguments. The matter is submitted.
Thank you.